Okay, good morning. Let me start. So today, I'll present the functional integral for fermions. So up to now, we have discussed how to quantize by functional integral methods, construct perturbation theory, and make the connection with a more standard canonical quantization method for a bosonic field, a field which describes a boson with spin zero. Now for fermions, there are additional difficulties, but this can be done, and that's what I'm going to explain today. So, fermionic path, integral path of functional integrals. So, what's the problem with fermions? Naively, you know, in first quantization, the free fermions described by the celebrated Dirac equation, that equation, which goes back to the early days of quantum mechanics, and the Dirac particle, spin 1/2, is described by a wave function with four components, which is in four dimensions, in 3+1 dimension, and which is described by a field phi of x, I mean space-time, which is just a component of psi alpha of x, where alpha are the Dirac indices. Okay, but each component of the Dirac field is a wave function for one of the components of the Dirac particle. So there are four in four dimensions. And in fact, four is two times two. Two are for the two spin degrees of freedom, because the spin is 1/2. And the other two is because this, the Dirac wave function, describes both a particle and an antiparticle. That's a great discovery of Dirac, from theoretical, from the mass predicting the existence of antiparticles. Okay? And so this Dirac equation, you know what it is. It's I d slash minus m psi, and in fact, equals zero. This is Dirac equation, one, so this is d slash, and which involves the gamma matrices. And in fact, this equation can be derived from an action principle, which, so you have an action, S of psi, well, it's complex. So in fact, S is a function of psi and its conjugate, complex. That's because it has spin one, it has charge, sorry. That's because, well, one in units of electron, minus one. And this action is simply, since this is a linear equation, this action can be written as integral over space-time of psi bar of x I d slash minus m psi of x. Of course, this is of course a vector, this is a 4x4 matrix, and you take the scalar products. Okay, so nothing special at the point of view of mathematics. You take the functional derivative with respect to the conjugate of psi at some point x, and you get Dirac equation. Okay, but that's for first quantization. So this is the action, which is the analog of the action for the Klein-Gordon equation. But the action for the Klein-Gordon equation turns out to be the action which in second quantization describes the scalar field. So is there a way to use this action for the Dirac wave function and make it an action for a functional integral for now a field psi, which is going to be the Dirac field, describing the sets of with an arbitrary number of particles and antiparticles. Okay, so this seems okay, but the problem is with the Fermi Dirac statistics. Fermi Dirac statistics. Well, let me keep this here. And the problem is that the problem or the difficulty is the Fermi Dirac statistics, which comes out, which was discovered by in the early days, because as a consequence of the form of the equation of motion, when you start to do second quantization, you discovered or just treat two particles instead of one, two fermions, you discover that they don't obey the ordinary statistics of boson, but those are fermions, namely that you cannot have two fermions in the same states. And the Fermi-Dirac statistics is something which you cannot avoid very easily, because in fact it comes out from a theorem which is called the spin statistic theorem, that I'm sure you have at least, it has been presented to you in the QFT1 course. The spin statistic theorem, in fact, is a very general theorem for any local quantum field theory. So it comes from locality in space-time. It's valid for non-extended object, plus Poincaré invariance, or Lorentz plus relativistic invariance, plus unitarity. Therefore, causality. Okay, so I won't explain how it. It's a mathematical theorem. It's not that difficult to understand where it comes from, but it's a theorem. Okay, and the spin statistic theorem, in fact, can be translated in the everyday life by the fact that when you try to quantize fermions, for instance, by canonical quantization, if you consider creation and annihilation operator of fermions. So if you have creation operator alpha dagger and alpha annihilation operator for fermions, I denote them with alpha to distinguish from fermion, they obey the commutation relation. So those are creation and annihilation operator for a single quantum state, they obey the commutation relation that, and here I'm just going to not make any mistake, that alpha, it's the anti-commutator, namely the sum of the products in two different, which is equal to one, or h bar in unit. Instead of for fermions, boson, of course, you have the R plus and A, or A dagger and A creation and analogy. And they obey the usual commutation relation. So that's anti-commutation relation. That's a general feature of fields which are fermions. Okay, for fermionic fields. And this has a translation in the fact, for instance, that when you consider in the second quantized Dirac theory, the fact that the fermionic operator, local field operators, they anti-commute when they are separated by a space-like vector instead of commuting. Okay, so this is the general feature of fermions. Object anti-commutes instead of commuting. And therefore, if you try to think of this as a field describing an arbitrary number of fermions and anti-fermions, how you can treat this psi of x as a field in functional integral, but taking into account anti-commutation relation, and not, you know, for the bosonic field, this would be a phi, and phi of x are just can be treated as quantum but real or complex field. So they're made out of commuting numbers, ordinary real or complex number. Okay. So the trick which was devised, or the mathematical solution to this question, is in fact is contained in some mathematics which are called the mathematics of Grassmann algebra and Bayesian calculus. And I'm going first to explain the math before going back to the Dirac equation, Dirac field. Okay, so Grassmann was a, forgot already his first name, was a German mathematician from the second half of the 19th century. He made important work in just defining the concept of vector space, for instance. So he was a pure mathematician from the east of Prussia at that time. And, oh, by the way, when I looked at what he did really in Wikipedia yesterday, I discovered that he's also known for making the first extensive German translation of the Rig Vedas, the famous, you know, religious books from the Hinduism. So that's fair. Okay, so Bayesian was a Russian and theoretical physicist mathematician from the 50s. Okay, so I'm going to explain what are Grassmann algebra, so which is a way to define some anti-commuting numbers, so mathematically rigorous to define anti-commuting. And then I'm going to see how Bayesian and other theoretical physicists use this concept, or rediscovered, and then use this concept to construct a functional integral. How can you integrate over anti-commuting number? Okay, so what is an algebra first? You know that, I think you know if you know a bit of math, that an algebra is a vector space. So it's a space which can be constructed out of a basis of generators. But in addition, so it has an addition. But it's an algebra. So it has also a multiplication. Which is a multiplication law. So for instance, matrices, you can add matrices, so they form a vector space, but you can also multiply matrices. And in general, the multiplication of matrices is non-commutative if they are not diagonal. Okay, and in addition, I'm going to need something which exists in for matrices, which is a conjugation that I'm going to call which is the analog for matrices to the transpose or Hermitian conjugation. Transpose for real matrices, Hermitian conjugation for complex matrices. Okay, so Grassmann algebra are a bit like matrix algebra, but they are different. Okay, so Grassmann algebra, I'm going to consider a complex Grassmann algebra. So it's an algebra based on the vector space, complex vector space, because we are going to be interested in a complex Dirac field because there is a charge. But you can define similarly real Grassmann algebra, and they are useful for some problem of physics, in particular in condensed matter. Okay, so I'm going based only to complex Grassmann algebra, so that it's going to be a vector space over C, field of complex number. Okay, and I'm going to consider what is a complex Grassmann algebra And I'm going to call this, well, let me call this a G to indicate that this is an algebra. So it's a vector space, which is in fact 2n dimensional. So it's a vector space which has a basis of generator. That I'm going to go to denote by Greek letters, theta, I, and another I, which will turns out to be the conjugate of theta. But at the moment, so you have a basis of generators from I equal 1 to n. So this makes 2n generators. But at the moment, you may consider. We associate theta I to theta bar of I, but that's going to be just at the next step. At the moment, you can consider you have just 2n generators of your algebra. Okay? So, but these are generators of the algebra. Which means that you may construct all the elements of the algebra out of linear combination of products of the generators. Okay. So out of this, you get products plus linear combination, and you get all the elements of the algebra. Okay, so the important properties for a Grassmann algebra is that those theta and theta bar anti-commutes. The anti-commutes, namely when you define the product theta I theta j plus theta j theta I equals zero, as well as the products of theta bar g theta g equals zero, as well as products between thetas and theta bars. So those numbers are anti-commuting numbers. When you take the product of two of those generators, so they are numbers in the mathematical sense, but they are not complex numbers. They are just objects. When you multiply them, they anti-commute, all of them. So at that stage, there is no difference between the thetas and the theta bars. Okay. And that's all. Out of those anti-commutation relation, we define all the higher order products and nothing more. So we have no more constraints. Those are just the generating constraint relations, the multiplication relations that generate the algebra. So out of that, we are going to generate this big algebra, Gn. Okay. So first consequence, this is valid for any I and j. So in particular, consequence, theta I squared equals zero, and theta bar g squared equals zero for any g. So multiplicating a generator by itself gives zero. You can never have higher order powers of theta than powers zero and one. Okay. Okay, so now, what is the general, so these are what are called the generator of the algebra. And now, how do you construct a general element, let me call it G, but with a little bar to remember that's an element of the algebra, of my big algebra Gn. It's just how to be constructed as a linear combination of complex linear combination of products of the thetas and theta bars. Okay. So let's consider just example. Simplest example, n equal 1. I have two generators, theta and theta bars. These are the generators. So what are the products? First, you can have a product with no thetas. So it's just the ordinary complex number 1. So a general G is of the form, is a linear combination of 1, theta, theta bar, and you cannot multiply theta with itself, but you can multiply theta by theta bar, and theta bar. So I can write theta times theta bar, but you could have written theta bar times theta, but that's just minus theta times theta bar. So these are the four possible term. And then you take a linear combination, so you can take, for instance, some complex number, plus b, plus e, plus d. Okay, so 1, theta, theta bars, and theta, theta bars form a basis of the algebra considered as a vector space. And that's a general form, a decomposition of G, a general element of the algebra as this basis. You see? So you see that as a vector space, the dimension of G1 is 4. Okay? And now, for n equal 2, you have theta 1, theta bar 1, theta 2, theta bar 2. So you have 4 generators of the algebra. And so, well, you can check that in fact, G is a linear combination of now of 16 terms. Those 16 terms are, well, 1, those 1, and then you can start to have two products. Yes?
Sorry, just for clarification, I think I missed it.
Yes?
Why did we write it's 2 n dimensional then?
Pardon?
Why did we write that Gn is 2 n dimensional if dim G1 is equal to 4?
Gn is not 2 n dimensional, you'll see.
Okay.
I take the example of 2. Because you have 1, theta 1, theta bar 1, theta 2, theta bar 2, but then you have theta 1, theta 2. So you can take any products of 2 up to theta bar 1. I'm sorry. Theta bar 2. And there are, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 6 of them. So here you have 1. Number is 1. Here you have 4 of them. Here you have just pairings of 4 elements. So you have 6 of them.
Yeah. What does that refer to?
Pardon?
On the left hand side of the board? On the left hand?
I'm sorry, that's 2 here. It was 2. Yes, what is your question?
Like the side where we wrote like complex Grassmann algebra Gn is 2 n dimensional?
Yeah, it's 2 n dimensional. So that's the notation. That's the choice of my notation in.
Yeah.
It's a complex algebra. Mm-hmm. So it in fact, it's a. It is a 2n dimensional, but I use this but n to remember that there is a n pairs of generators.
Yeah.
Okay, it's just a notation.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
What Jason refers to is that like vector space itself is not 2n dimensional, right?
Yes.
We have 2n generators.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
But basis elements we have more because we.
It's just a notational notation.
Products as well.
it has two n dimensional generator, but they are gathered by pairs. So,
so
it has n pairs of generators. Okay. So the notion of dimension here is not refers to the dimension of the vector space.
Right. Yeah.
Hope you will not get too confused. Okay, so here you have six pairings of four elements, if I'm not mistaken. It's just like in the Vick theorem. Yes. And then you have products of three, for instance, theta 1, theta 2, theta bar 1, or theta bar 2, etc. So you remove one. So you have four, and then you finally have theta 1, theta 2, theta bar 1, theta bar 2, which is 1. So if I am not mistaken, this is 1 plus 4 plus 6 plus 4 plus 1 equals 16 terms. So as a vector space, the dimension of G2 is 16. Okay, and now in general, for general n, you can check that the dimension of this algebra Gn as a vector space is 4 to the power n. Okay, so these algebras are quite big. Okay, and now we have to define, with those commutation rules, you can define what is the product of two elements. So let me just give the example, because that's a simple case. When I have, for the case n equal 1. So for n equal 1, for n equal 1, I consider two elements, G1, which is one A1 plus B1 theta plus C1 theta bar plus D1 theta theta bar, and G2, which is A2 plus B2 theta plus C2 theta bar plus D2 theta theta bar. And then, I didn't vote an example, so I'm pretty sure to do a mistake. If I compute G1 times G2, I just apply the ordinary rules. Of course, it's an associative algebra. I should have taken that it's an associative algebra. Associatives, that when you take products, you don't need to specify by parentheses what you are doing. Matrix algebra, associative algebra. So just compute G1 by G2. So you get, of course, A1, A2. Now, what are the terms of order theta? You can have A1, B2 plus B1, A2. A1, B2 plus B1. 1, A2, theta. Same for theta bar. A1, C2 plus C1, A2, theta bar. It starts to be a bit difficult when you consider what are the terms of order theta, theta bar. What are the terms of order theta, theta bar? Well, first you have A1 times D2, then you have the terms D1 times A2, but then you have the cross term, and you have B1 times C2, and then you have C1 times B2. But C1 times B2 gives C1 times B2 theta bar times theta, which is minus theta bar. So this is minus times B2. And that's it. Okay. And those terms are standard terms for linear algebra. The minus sign here is a sign that it's an anti-commuting algebra of anti-commuting numbers. First, and then that's it. Because if you multiply, for instance, theta by theta, theta bar, you have theta squared, which is zero. So it ends up there. So all the more complete, higher order terms in ordinary linear algebra of matrices, for instance, are not there. Okay. And then, well, you can repeat it. It's a good exercise to repeat it at least once for the algebra with four generators, two pairs on theta 1 and theta 2. It becomes cumbersome. But you'll check. Okay. So anti-commutation. Enters there. Okay, so this is a general definition of products. Okay, so I discussed, well, the addition is a standard addition. Multiplication is defined in this way. Finally, I'll need, when discussing fermion, what is the conjugation. And the conjugation is just the analog of transpose or matrices. End of complex conjugation. So it's an analog of complex Hermitian conjugate for complex matrices. So, first, we just need to know what is the conjugation of a complex number. For a complex number, you see, if you consider the element algebra, which is A times the identity. For a complex conjugate, the conjugate of a complex number is just its complex conjugate. Now, well, that's the reason why I choose this choice of notation for the pairs of notation for a generator. The conjugate of theta is theta bar, so it's interchange, and the conjugate of theta bar equal to, the conjugate of theta bar is theta. Conjugate is indicated by a star. That's a mathematical notation standard. And now, what is the conjugate of a product? So what is the conjugate of G1 times G2 for two general elements of the algebra? Well, we are going to choose the analog of matrices, where it's Hermitian conjugate of transpose, is going to be the products of the conjugate, but inverted. So this is going to be G2 star times G1 star. Okay? And that's enough to determine explicitly, for instance, the conjugate of theta I times theta G, theta G bar star is theta J times theta I bar, for instance. If you take a product of a theta and a theta bar. Okay. Okay, so these are the algebraic rules for manipulating, adding, and multiplying those Grassmann numbers, those anti-commuting numbers. Okay, so now Now, we need more for performing a fermionic path integral. You see that you may consider a general element of the algebra. It's a linear combination of products of generators. So you may consider this as the starting point of a series expansion in thetas and theta bars, except that because of anti-commutation relation, the series expansion has to stop at order 4 to the power n. And that's different for the series expansion of a function which is a function of some complex variable, where a formal power series goes to infinity. So you may consider G, you may consider as a function given by a series expansion in theta I and theta bar I. So it may consider being as a function, so it's like analogous of a function of anti-commuting numbers, variables. Okay. You know that the functions of some variable, they define a commutative algebra because you can add them. Here, the function of the generators, theta and theta bars, define a non-commutative algebra. It's non-commutative because the thetas of generators do anti-commute. But you can still think of them as function of some variables. And then, for ordinary function over the complex plane or over the real line, you have two important. Now comes analysis. We'd like to define derivation operation with respect to the theta and theta bars. And we would like to define integration over the theta and theta bars. You see? And derivation for ordinary functions maps a function into another function. Integrating over some variable for a function leads to a function which depends on less variable. Can we do that for Grassmann numbers, for functions of anti-commuting numbers? It turns out that yes, but the rule starts to be a bit strange. So I would like to know, I have a Grassmann numbers, I'm in an algebra Gn, which is generated by theta i's and theta bar i's from I equal 1 to n. So I'd like to define what is a partial derivative with respect to one of the generators from sort of general element of the algebra. And similarly, I'd like to define what is a partial derivative with respect to theta bar. Okay, so let's start from the simplest element of the algebra. First, I want to define that the partial derivative of 1, the generator of the algebra, is of course 0, as usual. Now I consider the term of order theta, some thetas. So I want to define that d over d theta I of some theta j, another generator, is just 1 if those are the same generator. zero, so it's zero. So it's delta I j. Okay, so as usual, if I take a partial derivative with respect to one term of degree, some degree, the degree drops by one. Okay, and similarly, d over theta bar j of d theta I equals zero, because those are necessarily different. And the same for theta bars of one equals zero. The partial derivative with respect to the generator theta I, j I, theta bar I of theta j bar j is delta I j, one if it's the same zero, and d theta I over d theta bar j is always zeros because, okay. Okay, and now if you want to define partial derivative for other functions or commutation of ordinary derivatives in ordinary calculus, they commute. Now anti-commutation, really. Now I want to enforce anti-commutation relation. Namely, I want that this operation when I take partial derivative for two different variables, I want the partial derivatives to anti-commute instead of commuting. And of course the same for the partial derivative theta I times d over d theta bar j equals zero, and the partial derivative with respect to theta bars equals zero. Okay? And this and this allows to compute everything in terms of derivation. For instance, example. I want to take the partial derivative with respect to theta 1 or theta, some theta I of theta I theta, I'm sorry, theta I theta j. The products. Well, first, I want to apply theta j to theta I, to the theta j air. But there is a theta I before. So first, I make them anti-commuting. So this is d over d theta j of theta j times theta I with a minus sign. Applying this to this gives 1. Applying this to this should give 0. So this is minus theta I. Okay. The same if I want to apply d over d theta I to theta k theta j, theta I, order in this order, then I have to anti-commute this with this, then this with this, so it gives 2 times minus is plus, so this is d over d theta I of theta I, theta k, theta j, so this is plus theta k, theta j. You see, so the rule is when applying d over d theta I to something, move the theta I, if there are any to the right, and then apply the derivative definition. And of course, in this, if in the products of theta you have no I, it gives zero, as usual, etc. Okay, so we have defined derivation. And
I have a question.
Yes?
For the first equation, are we assuming I and J are different, or is it just general result for all?
They are necessarily different, because if they are equal, this gives zero. Oh. Remember? So then you have D over delta G of zero, which is zero.
Oh.
So this is, of course, true if I is different from J. Yes. So then this would be zero, and d over d theta j of zero cannot be minus theta j. So you have to remember that when you, in a j, you can decompose it in terms of products of thetas, where all the thetas are different. The consequence of what I wrote here. In general, a general element of the algebra is a sum of terms A, and I can write I and J, of products of thetas and the products of theta bars. By choice, I can put all the thetas before the theta bars. I can order I can have some indices, products of AI by BG from I equal 1 to the cardinal some n, from g equal 1 to n, and by definition, I is a set of ai where a1 is smaller than a2, smaller than a3, up to an. So it's a order subsets of all the set of indices, and j is a set of indices b1 less than b2, less than b3, up to less than bn. And to each such subsets, you take the corresponding products, you add a complex number, the coefficient, you take the sum of all the i's and all the j, and this is a general form of an element of the algebra. And of course, the coefficient n and m here, I should be written rather like k and l. K, l, because k and l can be at most have to be less or equal to the number of generators. Otherwise, it means that you have at least two times the same index, and it gives zero. So this is a general form. So if I have a general element of these forms, and I want to take its derivative with respect to some theta, then I have to look for the terms where there is this theta A somewhere. Otherwise, it gives zero. If I want to compute d over d theta A of this g, I first have to pick the terms which contain this theta A, move the theta A to the left with the anticommutation relation, and then cancel it by this rule. Okay. Well, it's time to make a break. So let's make a short break, 5 minutes. And after the break, I'm going to explain how you can derive integration. So integration of functions. We have defined what is the derivative with respect to a generator of a Z element of the algebra. I'll see how we can define the integration with respect to an element of the algebra, with respect to a generator of an element of the algebra. And with that, we'll have all the rules we like, we want. Okay, so break and later, oops, I need the rest, later integration. So this was one, this is two, this is three, and this is four. Yes?
Sorry. I'm struggling to see the connection between, so you define a Grassmann algebra.
Yes?
Which is identical to forms as well. It's obviously just the. I don't see where the structure relates to Grassmann algebra. It's the same thing.
I think it's the same thing. It corresponds to what is called an exterior algebra. It's exactly because my theta I is correspond to what is called a DZ.
Yeah, your forms, right?
Forms. Theta bar I corresponds to the forms with respect to the complex number, and the products theta I, theta j is dzi wedge dzj.
Okay.
And theta I, theta bar j is dzi wedge dz bar j.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's exactly. So this Grassmann Grassmann-Bérezin notation that I'm using are exactly the same than the exterior algebra or forms notations.
Okay.
That's exactly the same things.
And
simply,
what about the partial derivatives?
The derivative, I'm not aware they correspond to something. Well, I'm sure they correspond to something
right,
in math,
okay.
Because this is just notation. But
yeah.
They correspond to, I think, some natural mapping between the derivation removes one theta. So if you have a vector space, you have a lambda k of E. I'm sorry. Yes, lambda k of E.
Uh-huh.
Derivation.
Takes you to lambda k minus 1.
Derivation is some natural from lambda k of E into lambda k minus 1 of E.
Okay. So it's like a contraction.
It's a contraction,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not so well, I forgot the.
Maybe interior
yes.
product.
Fine.
Interior derivative.
Interior derivative. I'm not sure.
Okay, that's fine.
I have to remember my math. I learned that when I was younger.
Thanks.
Interior derivative. That's for.
Does that exterior takes?
No, because interior derivative maps K form into K plus 1 forms.
That's
the opposite.
Yes.
Right?
That's exterior derivative.
No, that's exterior. Yes. No, that's exterior derivative. And interior derivative, I forgot what it was, but exterior, interior derivative should correspond to this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You mean it's a, you think it could be just the exterior derivative of the dual? Of the Hodge dual?
It's similar. It's like the interior derivative you contract with the first index.
Yes.
That's what you're doing.
That's exterior.
Yeah.
Yes. So these notations, which are the notation of physicists,
yeah,
have some mathematical, there is a mathematical dictionary.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that what you call interior derivative, you have the exterior derivative, D, which maps a form, degree K into a degree k plus 1 form.
Yeah.
But then you have, to a form, you have its dual. when you replace the decay by the, you know, the exterior products of forms by the remaining one.
Oh, you mean like the Hodge dual?
That's the Hodge. So if you want, by the Hodge duality.
Yeah.
To a form F, you have to F, you involve F, I think it's star, another star, not this one. And then I presume that the interior derivative
is the dual.
Is of F is probably D of F star, star, or something like that.
Yeah.
I presume.
Sure.
Well, if you are not fond of math, forget this. But. Okay. Well, break is finished. So now, integration. Well, integration, I want, starting from an element of algebra, define what is integral over delta I of the element of the algebra. These are formal notation. Okay, and then I want that this integral operation, when acting on generator of the algebra, acts in the usual way. So I want that integral, but I want that, in particular, I want to be able to perform integration by part. So I'd like to have when I integrate over some generator of the algebra, the derivative with respect of I of G, well, partial integration tells you that it should be given by the value of G at the boundary of the space. But here, those are formal generators. So if you want, theta I are not real variables defined on some on the line or whatever, on some segment, it's formal. So in some sense, the space of the theta I's have no boundary. So I want this to be zero. Even if I take the integral over dg, okay? So the same for the theta I and the theta bar I. So I want that always d theta of theta equals zero. So I want this to be zero. I want the integral over d theta bar I of d over d theta I of g of some g equals zero, whatever the j is. And therefore, this implies, for instance, that integral over delta I of 1 is 0, integral d theta I bar of 1 is 0. So when you integrate a constant, you see 0. And you see also that because of your anti-commutation, when you apply twice a derivative, you get 0. Because since you have never any squared of a generator, the first derivative removes the theta, and the second derivative acts on something without the theta, so it gives zero. Okay. So in fact, out of these rules, I want this. You can check that basically, the solution is very simple and very different from derivative with respect to integration in for ordinary function. It's just that by definition, I choose that the integration is the same thing as the operation of derivation. And that's the miracle of anti-commutating relation. I define a formal integration, but it acts on elements of the algebra exactly the same way as taking the derivative. And you can check with that that those integration anti-commutes, everything. And you can check that, of course, with this notation, integral over d theta I of theta j is delta I j. Integral d theta bar I of theta bar j equal delta I j, etc. So you see, the integral of theta is 1 instead of in theta squared divided by 2, and etc. So you see this integration, I wanted to obey this partial integration rule, and it turns out that the only way to obtain this is to take, consider that the integration acts in the same way as the derivative. So this seems a bit strange to choose this rules of calculation, but you'll see immediately that this has very nice properties. So we can define element of the algebra, we can define derivation, we can define integration. So can we perform with this rule of calculus Gaussian integrals? For fermionic anti-commuting numbers. Okay, let's do that. Let me consider what is the Gaussian of anti-commuting number. Well, I consider A equal AIG, an Hermitian matrix. Okay, and I define an element of algebra that I'm going to call the exponential of a quadratic form associated to A as the formal power series, which is exponential of minus the sum over theta I AIG theta J. Okay? So, what is this? The exponential is defined by its formal power series. So, it's 1 minus theta bar I aij theta j. Of course, I sum over the indices. So, this is sum over ij from 1 to n. But then it's plus 1 half theta bar I AIG theta G squared, etc. So this is the usual exponential defined by it's a series expansion. But I am in a Grassmann algebra. So after n steps in the series expansion, the series expansion stops. Because if I have a power of theta bar I AIG theta j, theta I bar I AIG theta g to power n plus 1, and I decompose this in powers, there is always at least one I where you have theta I squared, which is 0. So this is 0. Okay. So for instance, for n equal 1, exponential of minus theta bar A theta is just 1 plus A theta times theta bar. The term over the 2 vanishes, and the term over the 1 in minus theta bar A theta, and I use anti-commutation plus the theta. Okay. Therefore, now I can define something like what is the integral over d theta bar, in the case of integral 1, of this exponential minus theta bar a theta. Well, the integral of 1 is 0. Remember the first rule. And the integral of theta gives 1. The integral of theta bar gives 1. So this is a. Yes?
Shouldn't it be 1 minus a theta theta bar? Because you have exponential of minus theta bar alpha theta.
Yes, but this is, if you prefer, this is minus a theta bar theta. But I used anti-commutation relation of the thetas and the theta bar to write it as 1 plus a theta theta bar. Is it clear?
Because a is it has normal numbers.
Pardon?
Because a has just complex numbers.
Well, a is a complex number. This is an Hermitian metric, so those are complex numbers. Okay?
Okay.
Yeah. I should have written it as a little a, if you prefer. Okay. So, I'm a bit short in time if I want to go back to fermions. So now, for n equal 2, I consider that my matrix A is A11, A12, A21, A22. So I have 2 theta 1, theta 2. So I have to expand the exponential. It stops at order 2 instead of order 1. Okay. But when I compute now integral d theta 1, d theta 2, d theta bar 1, d theta 2, d theta bar 2, of exponential of minus the thetas times a times theta bars. In the expansion, I have only to consider in the expansion of the exponential of that, the last term, which contains all the thetas and all the theta bars. Otherwise, the integration gives 0. And what is the term, the last term? The second term is 1/2, and you have the square, so you have a combination of thetas, theta bars, and aig. And then you remove. And the result of the calculation, it's a simple exercise that is presented in the notes. It's A12, A21 minus, the exponential is contains the combination. So what you get when you integrate is A11, A22 minus A12, A21, which is a determinant of the matrix A. So you see, it's a simple calculation. And of course, this nice results extend to general n by n matrix. For general n, and integral d theta 1 d theta bar 1 ta-ta-ta, d theta n d theta bar n or exponential of minus a, the theta bars. Theta bars, i g theta g. For any matrices, in fact, the matrix doesn't need to be Hermitian but at that stage, because we are doing formal calculation. But this is always determinant of A. Okay. So integrals of Gaussians of exponential of quadratic forms gives you the determinant of the quadratic forms. And that's different from ordinary integrals, where you get 1 over the determinant. So this, you start to see fermions. Fermions, wave function, for instance, involves Slater's determinants. So this is a hint why this is useful for fermions. Now, better. So this was for Gaussians. Now, let's compute correlation functions. This is a formal. Let's compute, in the case of n equal 1, what I'm going to call theta bars, which, by definition, is integral over d theta bars exponential of minus theta bars a theta times theta bar divided by integral d theta bar exponential of minus theta bar a theta. And that's, in fact, I have to compute theta bar times theta. Well, exponential here is 1 plus the product of theta bars and theta bar. So when I multiply by theta bar theta, I get only theta bars theta, because the product of theta bar theta by theta bars is 0 because of anti-commutation relation. So when I integrate, I get 1. And here I get 1 over determinant of A. Okay. But determinant of A in this case is just A, because it's a 1 by 1 matrix. Now, let's do that for n equal 2. For n equal 2, I can compute theta bar I theta j, defined by this. Integral over all the thetas, d theta 2, well, theta bar 1, d theta 2, d theta bar 2 of exponential of minus theta bar a theta times theta bar I theta j, with ij equal 1 or 2, divided by the same, which we know now is determinant of A. Well, here you have to take in the exponential the terms which contains the other thetas and the linear terms. So then you have a 2 by 2 matrix. And if I'm interested in computing the IG equal 1, I have to take the term in the matrix, which is the opposite term. You see? And so if you compute, for instance, that theta 1 bar 1 theta 1 is A 2 2 divided by determinant of A. Well, this is a minor of a 2 by 2 matrix. So this is, in fact, a minor divided by the determinants. It's the element of the inverse. So it's A minus 1, 1, 1. And in general, theta bar I theta j is the it's always a minor divided by the determinant, so you get that it's a matrix element Aij of the inverse matrix, and that's general. This is for n equal 2, this is general. For any n. You see? And you can check by those anti-commutation rules that when you compute theta I theta j or theta bar I theta bar j, this is always zero. Okay? So, for a general matrix A, this is just a Wick theorem. This is a Wick theorem. You see? And now, can we do this? Now comes the great things. Compute 4 points expectation value. Take theta bar I theta j theta bar k theta l and compute it by the same calculation rules. So I take this integral over the thetas and the theta bars with now two thetas and two theta bars, and I divide by the determinant of the matrix, apply the same rules. Now you have to consider products of elements, and what you find is that this is A minus 1 IJ, A minus 1 KL, minus A minus 1 IL, A minus 1 KJ. Minus because of anti-commutation relation. So this is the fermionic Wick theorem. This is, if you want, the fact that this is a commutation of, I have I, J, K, L. This is mapping A with J, and K with L, or this, and this. And remember, you have to go from the to map a J with a K, so if you want those, you have oriented contraction. And this is this minus this. Those are the rules of the Wick theorem. You sum over contraction, but you had a sign which is a sign of the permutation between fermions. So this is a fermionic Wick theorem coming just from the algebra. And of course, this generalizes to two n points, well, two n expectation value. So these rules, which are seems very abstract, these are rules of calculation using anti-commutation relations. Gaussian integration gives you determinant. Taking expectation values of products of thetas and theta bars gives you, are given by products, combination of products of inverse of A. So determinant of A, if you want. Determinant of A is a fermionic partition function, or path integral partition function. And the A minus 1 is the fermionic propagator. Okay? The inverse of the element. And now you see that this formalism that I explained, tried to explain somehow in detail, we can apply it. It's applied in many domains of physics, but for quantizing the Dirac equation, you just use a dictionary. Now, path integral for the Dirac field. We have seen that there was an action for the Dirac field, which is just S of psi bar psi, of psi and psi bar, equal integral of a four-dimensional space time of psi bar of x, I d slash minus m psi of x. That's d slash with respect to x. Okay, and psi is psi and psi bar are a collection of psi alpha of x and psi bar alpha of x. So I have a collection of these with alpha equal 1 to 4. That's the dimension of the spin representation. That's Dirac index. And x belongs to Minkowski space, 1, 3. Space coordinate. Now, you can quantize just by consider that each of these now are anti-commuting generators of a very big Grassmann algebra. You see, so instead of having 2n generators, you have 2 times 4 times the number of points in space-time, which is infinite. So in fact, it's infinite dimensional. But basically, the dimension is, so you have 2 times 4 times the volume of space-time generators. So I have some kind of, well, you can call this, I don't know, some kind of very big infinite dimensional Grassmann algebra generated out of this. If you are a bit worried about the fact that the volume of space-time is infinite, you can discretize space-time, both time and space, take a finite volume, both for space and some boundary condition for time, and you get a finite number of x, large but finite. And you are back in the formalism of finite dimensional Grassmann algebra. Okay, so you replace the thetas and the theta bars by those psi alpha of x and psi bar alpha of x, which are now anti-commuting numbers. And then justifying the partition function, the functional integral by some z equal integral over the functional integral over psi bar and psi of exponential of I over h bar times this action for psi and psi bar. And integral here means big integral, products over x, products over alphas, d psi bar alpha of x, d theta and d. The order is, of course, a bit important. Where is my... there. No, it's not there. Yes, there. So this integral, d psi alpha of x. Okay, so this functional, this is a fermionic, a Grassmann integration. Well, here I have the exponential of an action, but the action is a quadratic form again. So, up to problem of checking whether this is well defined in infinite continuous space-time, this is formally the determinant of the operator. So that's it. Well, there is the I over h bar, but this is the determinant, the functional determinant of a 4x4 differential operator. So this is the Dirac operator. It is a 4x4 matrix, whose element is a differential operator acting on the wave functions. Okay, so I have the functional determinant of the Dirac operator. And now, if I compute, for instance, with those rules psi of x psi bar of y, or if we prefer psi alpha plus beta of x, by those rules general of general function, what I'm going is just the matrix element of the inverse of the operator. So it's get 1 over, well, I get I, in fact, I d slash, because of the I over h bar, get I h bar, I get the matrix element of this differential operator between the point x and y, and the matrix element alpha over beta of this, inverse of this differential operator. But this is just the Feynman propagator for the fermions, for Dirac. That's that we got from canonical quantization, and I think I should remove that a bit. Oh, I cannot raise this. Yeah. So this is a Feynman propagator. Hope you see this. So you recover by those rules of functional integral over anti-commuting Dirac field, you just recover Wick's theorem and the standard Feynman propagator, which is just, well, if I use that, you won't see. So, well, you know that the Feynman propagator for fermions propagator, if you derive it in QFT, one. And if you write this in momentum space, this is just, let me call it G for fermions of x minus y. This is just inverse Fourier transforms, exponential ip times x minus y. This is momentum of the inverse. Well, this operator written in momentum space where you can diagonalize it. So it's I over minus P slash minus M, and you can check that you recover the Feynman prescription. So this is the inverse of an operator of a 4x4 matrix. So you have to take the inverse of that. So you recover this is by this anti-commuting path integrals over anti-commuting field, you recover all the results of Feynman of a canonical quantization. So this seems very formal at that time, because at that stage, because we have just discussed that for the free fermions. But the advantage of this formulation are manifold. First, and fermions are on the same footing. Now, if you have a quantum field theory with both fermion and bosons, you write a functional integral over the bosonic fields, which are commuting variables, and the fermionic fields, which are anti-commuting variables. But that is, you, now you have the rules, and they, you have the same language to express quantization rules of functional quantization. So that's the first example. Interest of this formalism, and we'll see that in gauge theories. Where you have both the gauge bosons, which are bosons, spin one bosons, but bosons, and the fermions, which are spin one half fermions. Okay, that's fermions. So in now there is another, I will just explain something. Spin play no role in this notation. Spins appears just at the end, because you have to remember that in the case of Dirac, the fermion fields carry spin indices in order for everything to be consistent, and in particular to respect the spin statistic theorem and to have unitarity, no negative norm or problem with causality. Okay, but spin plays no role in this formalism. So you can apply it to problems of physics where the spin is not very important. For instance, in condensed matter. Of course, well, electrons in condensed matter have some spin, but it's not a relativistic spin. They have two states, spin up or spin down. So in condensed matter, this formalism is also useful. Another point is that in gauge theories, in order to quantize consistency gauge theories, one needs to introduce what is called Fadeyev-Popov ghost fields, which are there to make the quantization consistent when you use gauge fixing. And Fadeyev-Popov ghosts are spin zero charged bosons, fermions. So those are some kind of a bit strange fields, which are fermions. They obey the Fermi-Dirac statistics, but they are not spinors. They are spin zero. They are scalar for the spin, and they are fermions for commutation relation. They are there, I'll explain to that next week. Very important. They, of course, violate the spin statistic theorem, but they are there in order to cancel other violation of the spin of unitarity in naive quantization of gauge theories. And there are examples of fields where you, if you want to treat, to quantize gauge theories by functional integration method, you need to treat those fermionic fields on the same footing that gauge fields. And finally, let me just mention in 30 seconds, using using anti-commutating variables to describe some object which is has to do with fermions is very important in supersymmetric theory, because in in theories with space-time supersymmetry, which are an important feature of theory of unified theories, but also are very important in superstring models. Space-time, the ordinary space-time, or four-dimensional or 11-dimensional space-time, has to be embedded with additional coordinates, which are fermionic, in order to treat on the same footing fermions and bosons from the point of view of space-time symmetry. And therefore, those anti-commuting coordinates leads to a notion of what's called superspace. Which is a space with some coordinates bosonic and some coordinates of space-time fermionic. So that's important for SUSY, for superstrings, but also that's a domain which is very important and very well developed in math. So there is a lot of math, rigorous mathematics useful for many, which is the mathematics of what is called superalgebra. And you can find, full thick books of math dealing with the theory of superalgebra, their representation theory, et cetera, et cetera. And superalgebra, algebras where some generators commute and some generators anti-commute. So this is not just some fancy formalism to present in a complicated way, simple theory. Okay, thank you.